Hey everybody, this is Justin Case, episode 31, Case in Point. Jody, my usual co-host, is taking a little break. So with me today, I have my other co-host, Ponch. We're going to talk about some music today and talk about some rock stuff. We normally don't get to talk about that kind of stuff on the show, so I figured today was a good opportunity to do that. And so how you doing, Ponch?
I'm good, man. How you doing today?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. Just chilling out on a nice, clear Sunday afternoon. Yeah, this would be cool. So, Ponch, what do you what's in your MP3 player these days? If I'm allowed to call it that.
Yeah. No. I mostly listen to metal. Within metal, there's tons and tons and tons of genres and subgenres and sub-subgenres, within that. So,
What's your favorite stuff you got right now? What's currently on your hot list? Like, you find yourself constantly replaying.
Well, I think I mentioned this to you last night when we talked. There's a really, really good band. They haven't released an album in a while, I guess since like 2010 or whatever, but they're called, Umeria. And the album's called Rebel Mind. Sorry about that. They're super heavily influenced by Dream Theater, and you can tell from like the way the guy sings,
yeah,
and the guitar work,
the keyboards and such.
Yeah, and like the music, just the overall music composition. They're very, very solid band.
I saw the link you sent me, and it's funny because the guitar player is playing a Rusty Cooley signature Dean guitar. Which it's funny because I saw it and the guy's actually wearing the guitar the same way that Rusty Cooley does. He wears it like way up high so he can hit all those high notes. I'm more of an old school kind of, player. I don't like wearing the guitar way up that high. It makes it feel like I'm too much like a jazz player or something. But anyway.
Yeah, I figure that your arms would get kind of cramped after a while too.
I would
think, your shoulders,
yeah,
like being so closed in and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. I'd feel like you have those extenders under your arms in case you burned your armpits or something.
Yeah.
Like Captain Harris or something from Police Academy. Anyway, yeah. I saw those links you sent me. They sounded pretty good.
Yeah, so I listen to them a lot. Another band I sent you a link to, they're called Aeon Zen. They're influenced by a lot of guys, Dream Theater being one of the bands, Symphony X.
They're great. Symphony X is awesome.
I listen to them, too. I think I prefer their older stuff. I would say from their second album to, I think it's Divine Winds of Tragedy. I think that's the second album. From there to The Odyssey.
Yeah, those are they had that Gigantor it's probably been 10 or 15 years now, but it was mid-2000s, I think, and it was like Megadeth was the headliner, and it was really cool because they had Symphony X did two songs on there, and it was at the Montreal show, and it was really funny because iTunes had those for download for a little while, and then they pulled the Gigantor album off, right, because like Anthrax was on there, and they had a bunch of, I can't remember the other ones off the top of my head, but it was like Anthrax, Megadeth, Symphony X, and there was a few other bands. Oh, and Dream Theater was on there, of course.
And, yeah, they're on there.
Yeah, and it sounded okay, but I started noticing a difference because I actually found the Gigantor, and it had a much better, it had more clarity and stuff. I noticed that there's a lot of compression with Apple stuff, and I just could not get the track to really pop and have a lot of high end. It was really compressed, and so when I got the CD version, it was like, oh, this is great. I mean, this is the full spectrum of sound, and they just sounded amazing. They did like Sins and Shadows was one of them, and Inferno Unleash the Fire was the other tune that they did. They only gave them two songs to do, at least for the album, that's all they did, but it was just amazing because their vocalist is just, I mean, he's one of the best metal vocalists. Russell, I can't remember his last name. His name's Russell. We'll just call him Russell. And he's good. I mean, he's been with that band well, like 20 years, maybe longer than that.
That sounds about right.
Yeah, and it sounded pretty good. And he just had as far as I'm concerned, he had like the premier metal voice, but the songs were still melodic. It wasn't the Cookie Monster growl or anything like that. So yeah, 70X is definitely one of my favorites.
Yeah, they're really good. Yeah, so yeah, that's another band I listen to. I mean, I can go through a bunch, but like, I'd say within the last 5 years, I guess. I mean, I have like, now I'll always listen. I'll always make time to listen to like Dream Theater, of course, because for me they're tops.
Yeah,
and you know, like we said, Symphony X, Rush. You know, they're always a mainstay too. But I found myself also like really liking. This is gonna sound really out of place. Beatles, Sgt. Pepper, and On. So it's weird. Like I've been liking them, but then I've also been liking super aggressive stuff too. They're kind of prog-ish also, but I guess because of there's a band called Scar Symmetry where. They incorporate a lot of like clean singing and like growling Cookie Monster vocals as you called it before, but it's not like I don't want to say arbitrary is a word, but the way they handle it is that sometimes they sing in unison, or if there's certain aspects of a song that become super aggressive, they'll put in the growling singing, and then for like the more melodic and chorus parts of the songs, they'll go to like clean singing and stuff, and of course they have like the guitar solos and stuff, so it's kind of like taking prog metal and like amping up the aggressiveness to like a few notches above, but
sure,
it's really good stuff. I dig them a lot, but I'm trying to think what else recently.
You could be like that singer from Napalm Death that does those he did like a death metal version of Damage Incorporated. Damage Incorporated. That's all you could understand. What's that? The title of the song. Damage Incorporated. Barney. His name was Barney, and I don't remember his last name. Yeah, Barney.
that was cracked me up. You have such a like heavy, like wicked metal name, like Napalm Death.
Yeah,
and your lead singer Barney.
Yeah, it's funny. If I had a metal band, I would probably do a metal band based on Master Universe. I'd call it Havoc Staff. Wouldn't that be great? We'd do songs about Master Universe, and you know, probably wouldn't do it in a Skeletor voice, but that'd be kind of funny if he did. You know, it's like, you know, World Conquest. I don't know how he could sing in a metal voice because, yeah, he's always like, you know, I don't know how that would work, but it'd be kind of funny.
Yeah, that'd be kind of weird.
Yeah,
but I wonder if a band like I know, like Symphony X, they a lot of their lyrics are from like, you know, like I think mostly Greek mythology or like you know particular like. You know, like lyrical mythologies, like
you're getting into the deep subject matter. Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, they usually tend to focus on that you know, like fantasy based stories and stuff.
Oh,
and
okay.
So I want to see, you know, I wouldn't mind seeing the Masters of the Universe based band. I think from the last episode, Paul McGinty, he was mentioning like there's so much material to be mined from that universe.
Oh, yeah.
Where you know you can probably just focus on like. Kind of like the Metallium comes to mind, where they have like,
oh, yeah.
This
yeah.
epic sprawling storyline, and then like each album is like a chapter in that gigantic storyline. So maybe it can be handled sort of like that.
Yeah, they got some great tunes on there. I have both. I have the first two that they did. I don't know. They did a third, but I don't have that one. But it was awesome.
They actually have. I'm sorry.
You have all three of them, or how many do you have?
No, I have. I think I have the first two, but I checked. They're up to like album 6 or 7. They released quite a bit. Yeah.
Yeah. Is Mike Taranda still on drums?
I can't say for sure. I want to say yes, but I don't want to.
It's like a revolving door, probably.
Yeah, probably.
He's an awesome drummer. If you guys know metal drummers, Mike Taranda is definitely, I mean, at least, you know, back in the 90s and 2000s, he was the guy. Played like Yngwie Malmsteen and stuff, but he did a lot of power metal and that kind of stuff. Well, yeah, it was like, those are all really good. I mean, man, there's some really obscure stuff, but It's funny you're mentioning, like, you know how you could take, like, something with a property with a lot of deep themes, like, you know, Lord of the Rings. There was a there's a band called Blind Guardian, and all their stuff's about Lord of the Rings. And that you should check those guys out. They're pretty good. And I've got several of their albums. I got a double live album they did, and I've got I think I've got a couple of their studio albums. But they're I mean, their stuff's all about Lord of the Rings. That's their bag. And it I mean, it doesn't sound like it's a bunch of fanboys in a garage or anything. It's like legit stuff. I mean, they tour and they, you know, they're pretty big. They're a German-based band. They're pretty good.
Yeah, actually, the point you made about like the guys we listen to and that them not being like just a bunch of high school kids in a band just making noise. That's a big criteria that I have to think about when it comes to like trying out new music. Like, are these guys musical artists, musical acts, or are they actual musicians?
Yeah, is it just a gimmick?
Right. Yeah. Where they have, you know, like even if they do have some sort of like gimmick incorporated to the act, at least have they spent some time being proficient in the instrument that they're playing, or like, you know, as far as like a singer, have they spent time, you know, studying their, you know, musical or different types of singing, so they can, you know, like incorporate that into like their singing repertoire, if you will.
Yeah, where it's like the full package, and it's
right.
It's like nothing is worse than you hear a band and they write this awesome song. The riffs are great. The vocals are awesome. Drums and bass and everything. Even the rhythm guitars are awesome. And then when you hear a solo, it's just the most horrible thing, like nails across a chalkboard, because the guy can't bend in tune, and he just has no feel on the instrument, you know, no vibrato or anything. And it's just like, oh, you just ruined the whole song. It's like watching a movie, and the whole movie's great, and then they have one scene where it just brings the whole thing down, and you're like, well, not watching that one again. And I won't name anything specific, but I think you know what I'm thinking about. Yeah, so I'm cautious as well, and for that reason I'm cautious. It's like, I like the fact that we have MP3s, you can go online and, you know, try stuff out, and just see if they're any good, you know? And it's, I mean, it's interesting what you can stumble on if you go on, like, YouTube. Like, remember Udo Dirkschneider, the singer from Accept from the 80s? Balls to the Wall, anybody? And he has his band under his solo name, like Udo. It's just called Udo. And he did an album with, he released two double albums about 3 or 4 years ago. I have both of them. And I stumbled upon his, he did one with the German Navy band, and it just sounds amazing, you know.
Oh, wow.
And it's got heavy guitars. All his full band is there, but then they add the horns, and they've got like, you know, the classical type like chorus in the background and stuff. It's just amazing, and it's totally legit. It was a live event, so it's not like someone had like keyboard samples and just patched it all together. I mean, when you hear this stuff, you're like, how is this not being used in some kind of a major like motion picture, like a Marvel thing or something like that, because it just blew me away. And it's like you hear some music that when you hear it, it just like, I got goosebumps from this. That's how it affected me. And it was just like, there's some cool stuff out there if you look for it. And the other thing too is like, if you see a band, they're able to lay down heavy riffs and they got great songs and everything, but then they you know that they're having fun on stage. I mean, when you see them live, or you see a video of them playing live, it's just the best. And he definitely fits in that category. And
that's cool.
Yeah, so I highly suggest checking him out. And it was like, you can get like a double album, and then it comes with a DVD of the show that he did. And it's like $12. I mean, come on. If you try to do that 20 years ago, you spent $30-$40 for an import. Because they are imports, because they're German pressed. And I got them on Amazon that's where I got them, and I bought them for cheap, so factory sealed, so it's awesome. And I'm going back, and now that CDs are so cheap, I mean, you can go to like a store, like there's one called Fry's, and we have them over here in the Northwest. And I've been to the Seattle one's kind of picked over. There's nothing much left there. They sell mostly computer parts and home entertainment centers and stuff like that. But I went to the one in Beaverton, just south of Portland, and it's got a really amazing selection of CDs. You can get a brand new for $5 a piece.
Oh, wow.
So I was able to, like, I filled out my Journey catalog for, like, I got, like, four or five of their studio albums for $5 a piece. It's $20. It's, like, that's like what it would have cost you back in the 90s and early 2000s to get one CD. You know, I mean, it's the best. And I was just, before I did this podcast, I was reading about how the physical store experience is kind of coming back and people want physical copies of CDs and movies and stuff again. And it's really amazing because there's a benefit to that. I think it's in a sweet spot. And being able to get these kind of things at that price is like kid in a candy store.
Yeah, and I've also seen some bands, too, they, as an incentive to have people buy the physical disc instead of, you know, like, listening to the album on Spotify or buying it piecemeal on iTunes, they'll have, like, exclusive artwork, or sometimes they'll even have, like you were saying, some bands, they'll have a two disc set where the first disc is the album itself, and then the second disc might be, like, random concert footage or, you know, like, a recording of the album type of video footage. So, it makes me glad that there's a certain little uptick in interest going back to, like, physical media. Because I think, I want to say in the UK, I remember reading sometime last year where physical media, I guess, like, the combination of CDs and vinyls outsold digital music sales for a certain amount of time. So that's pretty neat.
Well, and that's the thing, though. Like I mentioned earlier, the compression you would get off, like, an Apple, like, MP3 off the iTunes store, depending on the kind of music, it's not, the quality is not good. And real hardcore enthusiasts know that, and it's always discussed online in forums and stuff like that, like sound quality variations from MP3s that you get that have that encoding for Apple or something like that. And because I noticed I got stuff from, like, Amazon, it doesn't have that problem because it's, like, more of a traditional MP3. It's not the proprietary junk they put on there. So I started just buying physical CDs, and then, like, you can have the auto rip feature on certain ones, so when you buy it, you can automatically download it to your library and it's already there, so you have both. And you get the full tilt sound quality as if you burned it off of a CD. So it's pretty cool. But I'm a sound guy. If something's off, I'm going to notice and it's going to drive me nuts.
Yeah. And you know, the thing about, like I think I don't use iTunes much to get music. I'll use the app to listen to it. But
Sure. Yeah. And that app works fine. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think they may offer, like, FLAC quality music. I'm not sure about that, but things like Spotify and stuff, like a hardcore audiophile, they're not going to be using that to have, like, impeccable sounding music, because it's there's, like, depending on the type of subscription you have, if you have a paid subscription, you have the option of having higher quality music, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's gonna be, like, CD quality. It's encoded in a way, like you're saying, like, it's easily digestible for the masses, but for me, if I want, like, CD quality sound, I'll just buy the disc itself, and I'm old school, and I'll just rip it in, like, a super high quality MP3, or, you know, like, convert it from FLAC to high quality, whatever conversion process, as long as it's got, like, super high quality sound to it. And a lot of times, doing that, the file sizes tend to be super huge, but you know what? At least I'm getting my nice quality sound and my music.
Well, yeah, right, and that's the thing, is, like, it's, you can always get, like, a external hard drive. I've got a 4 terabyte one, you know, and that's going to be plenty for me. And it's like, I mean, with the solid state, you know, hard drives, like my external hard drive I just got, it's a solid state, so it's, like, you know, awesome. And it takes it's like the size of a typical smartphone, instead of being the size of a tablet, you know what I mean, in comparison, because it doesn't have that disc in there spinning, it's a solid state. So just technology's gotten a lot better. But I kind of want to touch on, like, what was, like, the first metal band to really probably Dream Theater would probably be the first one that really got you into that, or was it like Metallica, or who was it that really bit the bug? You, what bug did you really get bit with as far as a
band? For me, it definitely was Dream Theater, but I think there was a process to getting to that point. Because I don't know about you or anybody else listening, but for me at least, growing up, you had, you know, you constantly had music for, you know, whatever era you're growing up through, that type of music was playing in the background. So like the 80s, you had, you know, like the cheesy pop music, or the, you know, hair metal, whatever.
Then awesome bands like Van Halen. Yeah.
Yeah, well, whether they are or not, I couldn't really remember. I just know, like, that stuff was in the background, but I wasn't really paying much attention to anything of it. But I just knew there's music going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it wasn't until when I got into, I would say, 8th grade. Well, actually, backing up a tiny bit, I think in 6th grade, I was in a school where we had to take a school bus, you know, for, like, there was, like, 20 or 30 minutes bus ride. And this kid, they gave us assigned seating. So the kid I was assigned to sit with, he was a huge metalhead, like you know, like the top names: Metallica, AC/DC, you know, Megadeth, Anthrax, you know, all those bands. He ate them up and
bring the noise. I love it, man. So great.
Yeah. So I think he at the time, again, I hadn't figured out what type of music style or just music type I liked. I just, if it sounded good to my ear, I listened to it. If not, then whatever. So I remember him trying to, like, sort of indoctrinate me that, yeah, like, Metallica is great. Let's check out this album. Megadeth is great. You know, Iron Maiden is great, blah, blah, blah. And it kind of went through one ear and out the next. And I think as I was getting closer to high school, 8th grade, again, like, I move into a different school, and a lot of the kids that I end up hanging out with in school, they listen to metal again. So, and then 9th grade, I try to venture into, like, stupid pop music, and that was just horrible. I'm glad I didn't stick with that. And I think going over your place when we're in high school also, I remember, like, as we were sleeping, and even when we were sleeping, you had, like, Van Halen playing in the background, or, like, Ingrid Malmsteen, or Dream Theater, or Rush, or whatever. So I think all that culminated into, like, I would say junior, senior year in high school. And I know you've played Dream Theater when I've come over before, but I never really put much thought into it until... you remember that that Z-Rock radio station used to have in Watertown?
Yes.
Yeah, they mostly played pretty horrible music, but there was I noticed there was a segment, if you listen to it late enough at night, they actually start playing really, really good music. And
yeah, it would probably depend on the DJ that started, because they could have free reign to do whatever they wanted, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So the DJ, I don't remember who the DJ name was, or he had some band being interviewed. Again, I don't remember the name of the band, but they were raving about Dream Theater, Dream Theater, Dream Theater. I was like, these guys, this name sounds familiar.
Yeah.
And the song that, like, really hit it for me was the radio edit version of Home. And I listened to that, and it was almost like my mind just friggin' exploded. It's like, I was, God created me to listen to Dream Theater.
Yeah.
And and then it just went from there, and I told you about it, like, yeah, here's the album where the latest one. At the time it was Metropolis Part 2, I think, had just come out. And
was Scenes from a Memory Part 2. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, and I remember, this is kind of funny, it might be stupid, but it was funny to me. When I finally listened up into Home in the album, the song was actually like a 12-minute epic album or epic song. And I remember listening to it, and I'm thinking to myself, wait, this is not the song I heard on the radio. This is wrong.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But that song and in turn that album, that's what sparked it for me. And I said, nah, I'm a metalhead, so it went from there. And got all their Dream Theater studio albums, a lot of their B-sides. I've got most of them, all of their concert DVDs. I've been to several of their concerts, so...
Yeah. Well, being in New York, I mean, you get to go to the best... That's their hometown, so, I mean, it's... I mean, it's like they're playing Madison Square Garden, they're playing all, like, Jones Beach, you name it. And, you know, the thing is like, don't forget Radio City Music Hall, when they did the Score album, that was just amazing. Full orchestra and everything. And
That was actually, didn't mean to cut you off, but that's actually my first major concert I went to of Dream Theater.
Yeah, you held up the cell phone for me, and I actually heard it. And you sounded like Michael Jackson on the other end, because you're going, woo! Because you're so excited, you know. It was so funny. And but it was like, I remember before Scenes from a Memory, was it Part 2 came out or whatever? It was, Change of Seasons was the first Dream Theater album I ever bought, and you heard that song, and there was a specific riff in there that Petrucci was doing, the guitar player, John Petrucci, and you're like, that is amazing, that's so awesome, it's so metal. And I remember that's when your ear kind of perked to what they were doing. And I think I actually let you borrow the CD, and you had it for a while, and it was just really cool, because I was like, I had originally heard that band. I had this crappy 486 computer, and I got some themes for it. Yeah, and it was on, like, I think I had, like, a disc. I had, like, a CD-ROM that had, like, different themes on there, and there was, like, a metal one on there, and Dream Theater was... had like a theme, so I downloaded that. So anytime you clicked on an icon, it would play the intro to one of their songs. And that was and I'd seen them in like Metal Edge magazine and stuff, the now defunct Metal Edge magazine. I had like mini posters of them and stuff. I'm like, I don't know who these guys are, but then when I started listening to them, I'm like, oh, this is great, because not only could they do like straight metal stuff, they could do like Rush tunes, they could do everything Rush to Iron Maiden to Genesis to you name it, even Elton John, they could do all of it. And on that Change of Seasons album, they did that big medley there, where they had like Kansas on there, like different classic bands that they really liked, and they made it was just a big medley, and they wove it together. It was just amazing. And they did like Perfect Strangers on there. Man, that song's great.
Oh, man.
And it was
their version's fantastic.
Oh, yeah. I mean, James Labrie on vocals, and Petrucci, I mean, his guitar is just screaming on that thing. And it was just like, it's just amazing. And I'm like, you know what? I'm now officially a fan after I heard that. I mean, that was just great. It was cool when they had Bruce Dickinson. It's on a Once in a Lifetime, at that time, VHS that they had. I played that thing to death. I still have it. And... it was like they had Bruce Dickinson on there doing Perfect Strangers. They had him in the studio, and they just never released that version of the song. And it was funny because he had the really long hair. He kind of looked like looked like Cousin It from the Addams Family. And I was like, and maybe Bruce Dickinson, I mean, seeing that guy live, that guy, he can put on a show, man. And it's like, I'm not an Iron Maiden fan, but it was like not hardcore. But it was like when I saw him at Darien Lake, I mean, he was jumping all over the place. I'm like, this guy's like in his 50s and he's jumping around like a spider monkey. It was amazing.
You know, it's funny because I also saw Maiden live, but only because Dream Theater was opening for them at the Madison Square Garden back in, when was it? 2010. And what's kind of crazy to me, at least, is... this show was the same year that Portnoy eventually left the band.
Mm-hmm.
So I was able to see him still with the band and, you know, opening up to one of the bigger influences. So that was awesome. But like when Dream Theater opened, I'd say it was about maybe a half hour, 45 minute set. And they played a lot of their hits, but, what got me was they played Home, and that was the first time I ever saw that live at a concert. And man, I was higher than cloud nine at that moment. And yeah. So kind of interesting story too. While Dream Theater was playing, I wasn't on general admission. Like I wasn't on the show floor, because if you're familiar with the layout of the garden, mm-hmm. you have the main floor where all the sports events happens, where like the Knicks play there or the Rangers, that
right.
we see the court or the ice. That's where like the general admission. And then off to one of the sides of the, let's say the ice rink, you have the stage set up, you know, on one opposite end, and then filling up the rest of the space are all the general admission seats. And then the rows going up from there where, you know, like the rest of the people sit. So I sat, I would say maybe 10 to 12 rows up from the event floor. And so I was close enough. I would say I was on the side where John Petrucci was playing at. So that would be on the right side of the arena. And where I was sitting at, I would say two or three rows to my right, two or three rows down, there was like a small group. Like it was like a lady, I guess her kids, and maybe one or two of her friends. And while Dream Theater were playing their set, as they're getting close to finishing, I remember a spotlight being shined on that area where those people were sitting at, and they were like waving like crazy. And I saw John Petrucci like looking at that area and like waving back at them. And I come to find out that
his wife and kids or something, or
that was them. And it made sense to me because after Dream Theater finished their set, and while we're in the intermission between Dream Theater and Iron Maiden going on stage, that group emptied out. So. So they didn't stick around for the Iron Maiden portion of the show. But, yeah, I'm not a ginormous Maiden fan. I mean, I've been growing in my appreciation for them has been growing lately. Because at the time, you know, like us growing up in church, they always had that stigma of like, oh, Mark of the Beast 666, they're horrible. But, you know, their music isn't solely just that. And they're insanely melodic. Their guitar work is fantastic. And Bruce Dickinson, even now, even though his voice is diminished compared to even like 10 years ago, he still has phenomenal range. And
sure.
The show, actually, this is the same year that Ronnie James Dio died as well.
Oh, boy. So
I think as a tribute, they played Blood Brothers.
Oh, okay.
For Dio, which was awesome. But yeah, Bruce Dickinson, man, I don't know how old he was during that concert, but 40s, 50s, I don't know, but the dude was jumping around all over the place, doing like midair kicks and
super high energy stuff.
Yeah, like you just could not contain it at all. Like if he had, it seemed like he reserved all of his energy for that show, and then he just exerted every ounce of energy he had just for that concert. And man, it was fantastic. And you know that I'm not really well versed into the what band members were in the group at that time, but like the guitarist, he was just top form. Like basically everybody was just top form, and it was a fantastic show.
At that show, did they have three guitar players? Because you have Dave Murray, Yannick Gehrs, and Adrian Smith. Those are the three guitarists. And it's like the bassist is Steve Harris. He writes a lot of the lyrics. And of course, everyone's favorite Jason Robard impersonator, Nico McBrain, on drums.
I had to do it. Oh, and of course, you have Eddie too.
Yeah, right?
He came out.
Yeah, exactly. The big stage set, you know. And it was great because they brought him out at Darien Lake. It was hilarious. They're still at it. I mean, they still tour and everything. It's amazing. It's really impressive. And but like there was like at Darien Lake, Rob Halford had his band there, and he was just like screaming vocals, man. That guy, let me tell you something, that guy had serious stage presence. I mean, because it was like him, and then it was Queensryche when Geoff Tate was still in the band. And I'm
Geoff Tate.
Geoff, yeah. And it was like, that was definitely, like, Michael Welton, their lead player, he's always been pretty good, but they didn't play material that was very, like, metal. You know what I mean? It just, they didn't play their heavier stuff. And I was just like, because they're trying to promote this, Q2K album that they had all the time, and they had another guitarist named Kelly Gray who was in the band, and he's not in there anymore, but it's like, so it was like, you didn't have Chris DeGarmo and Michael Wilton, like the classic lineup, you know, for guitarists there, and it was underwhelming. They played they played Empire and they played Jet City Woman, you know, I mean, those are classics, you know, but it was like, they played a lot of stuff off that album that it just didn't hit. In comparison to the other two bands, I mean, it's like, you know, you've got the Rob Halford solo album that came out in like 2000 that was just like, you know, hit you in the ribs, and then of course you got Iron Maiden with all their classic sets, and it was just like, you know, they made Queensrÿche look like pansies, you know, and it was like, it was, well, just, I thought it was a funny choice, you know, and
In my opinion, as far as Queensrÿche goes, everything after Promised Land, with the exception of Operation Mindcrime 2, I think it's not good, man. I even checked out their most recent album, where I think it was the first one after Jeff Tate left the band, and actually the guy from Crimson Glory, he's the lead singer.
I knew that.
Yeah, and I was really, really hoped, because I remember, I don't remember the album offhand, but the album where Crimson Glory had the song Astronomica.
Yes, I know about that. Yeah. Yes, I got annoyed with that. It's kind of cheesy. That.
Yeah, no, it is, but I just remember, like, the singer, he had some power to his voice. Like, it wasn't...
Oh, it's good. I mean, no, he's impressive. I just meant the song kind of annoyed me after a while. I liked it at first.
Oh, yeah,
And I was like, oh, okay, I've heard enough of this, you know.
But, so I was hoping he would bring some of that, but it just sounded like he was trying to ape Jeff Tate to the point even where he does that annoying, like, I don't even know what to call it, but for a while Jeff Tate had this thing of, like, when he starts singing, he has like, I don't know how to describe it, but this guy was doing the exact same thing. It was like, dude, stop copying Jeff Tate. Just,
well, that's what they want, sing. Though. I mean, they want to fill that gap. I mean, he's the hired gun, you know, he's going to do what they tell him. I mean, I don't know who the driving force is these days of that band. It's probably like Michael Wilton might be the guy, but I mean, I don't know. It's the stuff that's going on right now. You've got in some other news, you've got, the Kiss reunion that's going on
again.
Well, it's kind of like an Ace and Gene Simmons, Ace Frehley reunion, which is kind of significant because Ace and Gene never got along. And they're doing, like, this Gene Simmons vault tour. And the vault is, like... the vault is $2,000.
Holy cow.
And I'm like, for what you're getting in there, that's not $2,000 worth of merchandise. It's, like, solo Gene albums that he's like, yeah, some of it's good, and some of it, you know, is the first time you've ever heard it or something like that. And I'm like, okay, well, do you think it's good, or are you just putting stuff out there, you know? And it's, like... it's so Gene is teamed up with Ace to go promote that vault. And brace yourself for this. If you want to have a private concert in your home for 2 hours with him to show up, $50,000.
What?
50,000 big ones.
Wow.
Yeah. Pass.
Man, does he see? I know Kiss, for most of the history, they've been one to basically sell the soul for the sake of, like, merchandise sales and stuff. So, you know, I understand that, but does this guy really think there are enough fans out there that would hear that and think, hey, 50,000 for 2 hours, Gene Simmons? All right, let me throw it down. Let's have him.
They'll do it. The Kiss Army fans will do it. I mean, if you really think about it, it is crazy, but when you think about it, most of his fan base, or I should say Kiss's fan base, are older established people that have pensions or have money saved up, and they can put, okay, hey, if you do 10 grand, I'll do 10, you do 10, or whatever you do, or they get, like, you know, 10 people to pitch in $5,000 a piece, they'll do it. I mean, it's not that far-fetched, but I mean, this is just me, but when you see the kind of house that Gene Simmons lives in, and then he's going to go to, like, a regular person's house, like us regular folk, it'd be like, okay, it would just be awkward. You know what I mean? Just regular schmo's house. You know what I mean? It's weird. That's my opinion, but I just, I don't know. Yeah. But
yeah, I'm sure whoever's throwing down that kind of money to see have Gene Simmons personally hang out with them for a few hours are not going to be living in some rundown home. So,
well, no, or unless they rent like a clubhouse at like an apartment complex or something. I don't know. Because those are pretty good size. That's easily done. So they could probably do something like that. But I mean, you know, the thing is like it's there's some weird stuff going on right now with like. Vinnie Vincent, he was a one-time guitar player for Kiss, and he essentially pulled them out of the rut they were in, as far as a lot of people are concerned. He wrote Creatures of the Night and Lick It Up, those two albums, and really pulled Kiss back into the 80s, got them back on the map in the 80s, and, you know, he's reemerged after a 20-year hiatus, and... I didn't think a lot of it. I'm like, okay, well, maybe he's just ready to go do stuff, you know, and saw opportunity there. But then I listened to Eddie Trunk, who I catch a lot of his shows after the fact on YouTube, and he said he made a very good point. He said these guys are starting to reemerge because the royalties have run out. And so, you know, I think I'm inclined to agree with that. And it was like, this people aren't buying CDs anymore, and these guys are starting to get kind of like fallen in the back because, you know, they're older guys and the newer generations and stuff aren't listening to this kind of music. So like, we got to get back out there and get our names back out there to get some money coming in, you know what I mean? And so, and I think that it sounds like Kiss is going to be retiring soon. Like, they're going to wrap things up within the next couple of years. I mean, Paul's voice is gone. Paul Stanley's voice is gone. It's bad. I didn't realize how bad it was.
It's funny, like, kind of going back to revisiting what we were talking about before with Queensryche.
Yeah.
I mentioned how unless Queensryche has released another album since I listened to the most recent one with the dude from Crimson Glory.
Yeah.
But I read this... really weird story as to how I guess the events that led to Jeff Tate leaving the band. I don't remember exact particulars, but it got pretty messy. And I believe they're still having legal mm-hmm. battles within each other. But the band that Jeff Tate eventually made, they call themselves Operation Mindcrime.
Yeah,
Make everything more confusing. But his voice... oh my goodness, this is garbage, man.
Oh, it's pretty much shredded now at this point, huh?
Yeah, it's you can tell he's trying to sing like his old self, but it's just not there, man. It's
well, you know what happens? I mean, the scar tissue builds up on the vocal cords. It just isn't the same. And my good friend, he co-wrote a lot of the music for the podcast with me. My buddy Ben, he's a huge Queensryche fan, and I'm going to get him on the show here at some point. Our schedules just haven't lined up yet, but he's seen Queensryche a million times to me because he used to live up in Seattle. So we talk about this kind of stuff with this band, and he filled me in about all the legal problems that are going on and the conflicts and stuff. And you got to think at some point, you know, these bands either have to bury the hatchet and then have a retirement tour or something and just move on and enjoy the fruits of their labors, or can you continue to just keep putting out music that is segmented from what the original band was? And in my opinion, there's far less money to be made for the band if they don't have all the original members in there. Because the fans want to have all the original members in there. And it doesn't matter if the singer is better or the replacements are better or whatever. It's like the fans only see the original lineups, ultimately. And it's like with Ozzy retiring this year, it's like, he's doing a retirement tour with Zach Wilde back, you know, and everybody loves that.
Wow.
My idea is to have all the guitarists that are still alive in the band to play their select songs, and then have a big jam session at the end of the set, like the G3 tour does, right?
That's pretty cool.
That Steve Vai and Joe Satriani, well, it's Joe Satriani's tour, but he does the G3 and the G4, where you have G3 being three guitarists or G4 being four guitarists. They do their individual sets, and then they have a big jam session at the end. I thought that it would be cool if Ozzy did that with the individual guitarists, and then they come back out, like Jakey Lee, Bernie Torme, Brad Gillis, you know, Joe Holmes, the guys that are still around, and then come back out and play. I mean, obviously, some of those guys, like Bernie Torme and Joe Holmes, they didn't, you know, they did parts here and there for Ozzy stuff. I think Bernie Torme was just a touring guitarist for a little bit, but for a few shows, and then he had to leave. But it was like, I think they should do something like that. I think that'd be a good idea. And because Jakey Lee, he's another guy that came out of the shadows to go tour with his band Red Dragon Cartel, and it's like people know him from his stuff with Ozzy. And then there's a band he was in the late 80s, early 90s called Badlands. And some of their Jody and I laugh about that, and Jason, my brother Jason, we laugh about that. And you know, it was just like, I mean, yeah.
You know, I laugh because I think I listened to it in college. I think after I might have like maybe had a chance to listen to it with you, but because I knew a guy in college that he was like a huge metalhead too, and he's like, yeah, check this out. It was, you know, like you talk about the guitarist you're talking about, and for me at least, it was so bad that I don't remember it. I just remember listening to it and being so disappointed that I did not want to finish listening to it.
Was it Jakey Lee you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah.
Was it his Badlands group that he was in?
Yeah, I think first album, man. Yeah.
Yeah, they've got their diehard fans. But yeah, I mean, his stuff with Ozzy was a lot better. But it was like, because I think with the Badlands stuff, he's trying to go like almost like a Southern rock kind of feel almost. But it was like, not really Southern rock, but just a different flavor, you know, and which is fine. Hey, that's fine. More power to him. But it was like my stuff for him would be like Bark at the Moon, that album Bark at the Moon. And, you know, I love the riffs that came up with that. He came up with on that album, and he put up with a lot of crap from Ozzy. Like he'd wake Jakey Lee up in the middle of the night and demand that he write songs, and you know, because Ozzy'd be high off his gourd, and he's like, oh, come on, let's write it, come on. It's like, you know, or whatever he was doing at the time. Let's write a new riff, you know.
I would like to imagine that he would not be able to pull it off as Zach Wilde, because that guy is a beast, man.
Zach Wilde is he's huge. I mean, and he's got the strength to pull those riffs off. And I mean, Zach Wilde is, he's a mastodon. That guy is, he really is.
That's a good word.
Yeah.
I like that word.
He's one of my favorite players. And the stuff he's able to do, like, especially like his live stuff was cool. Like, there's that one Ozzy album called Just Say Ozzy. That's the live album they did. And they did the live version of Shot in the Dark they did on that. There's an extended guitar solo on there. When I heard that, it just blew me away. I would rewind that part before that outro solo started again. I'd listen to it like 30 or 40 times, man. I'm just like, this is so great. I love improvised stuff that sounds awesome, that fits the song.
That's cool.
And it was like, I was a big Zach fan at that point. That's what sold me. And I mean, look at the great albums he came out with Zach. It was like, Osmosis and, I mean, you got like songs like Perry Mason and stuff like, man, thanks. I mean, those are just great songs. I mean, I could go down a whole laundry list. There's like 30 or 40 riffs that are just a killer. And I mean, it's just
No More Tears.
No More Tears. And I mean, it's incredible.
You know what I like about him too, is he's so versatile. Cause, I mean, I know a decent amount of Ozzy stuff, but I'm not as knowledgeable as, like, say, like the stuff he did with Derek Sherinian in the his solo album.
Oh, those are great!
So good.
Oh,
man. So
good. Yeah.
And even within, like, what was it, like, Was it Black Utopia or Mythology? I don't remember which one, but
He wasn't on Mythology. He wasn't on that one, but
maybe it was. Was it Black Utopia?
Yeah, it was Black Utopia. He was on that one, and then he was on. He was on a couple of them.
Yeah.
The other one was Blood of the Snake, the one where like Malmsteen's on there and Zakk Wylde's on there. That's like a crazy album. John Petrucci's that one too.
Not that one. I think the first album he did with Derek Sherinian.
Oh, the first album? You're right.
Just within that first album, like he goes from super heavy shredding, like just straight up punch you in the face type of riff to like super calm, like soothing, like relaxing type of guitar playing, and then everything in between. It's just a fantastic album. The guy is just, he's a sick guitarist, man. Dude, really good.
And a great, awesome piano player. And the thing is, I love his vocals too. I mean, he could pull off he could pull off the Ozzy stuff, you know? And a lot of his Black Label stuff that he did, it was a lot of those songs were ones that he wrote that Ozzy didn't want to use. And I'm like, this is amazing, you know? Yeah. And you've got like Sonic Brew. And those are the kind of songs that if I'm like really ticked off, I put those on and it's therapeutic for me. And, you know, it's tired of this, tired of that, you know, that's really like the lyrics that I'm just kind of, you get sick of it, you know, and it helps you funnel that off, you know, it rolled it off and then you're able, okay, got that out. Now I can move on with my day. And, it's just the riffs and everything. It just kind of, it meets you where you're at, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. It hits you in the right spot. It's like, I'm not a big White Lion fan, but not White Lion. We'll talk about Vito Bratta on a separate episode. No, Great White. There's a song that they did called "Face the Day," and it was a song about like not wanting to get out of bed. You know what I mean? Because you don't want to get up. You know, you just want to sleep. And just songs like that are just like, oh, you know, it's like a Monday morning and you have to go to work, and you're like, what? What fresh hell is this? You know, and that song will play in my head, and I just start laughing, and I feel a lot better, you know. And it's, but I mean, yeah, I mean, it's, a lot of these guys are starting to close up shop, and it's like, you know, for years you've been loving the content coming out and stuff, and you get guys like I mean, Randy Rhoads. I mean, his life was cut short. He was 24. I think some people say he was 23, but I remember VH1 Classics. I remember back in the day said he was 24, but I think he was actually 23 when he passed away. But it was like a lot of people said like he wouldn't have stayed in Ozzy's band, you know, if he had lived. He would have went off and done other things. He's starting to get sick of it, you know. And but we'll never know. I mean, that's speculation. But like, I love hearing his gear set up. I love his playing. His tone and everything was just awesome, and it's just really cool. Like every once in a while, I'll just go back and I'll read up on his gear setup and how he got his sounds and the kind of things he did. Cause he was a little guy. He was a little dude. He's probably like 100 pounds soaking wet. And like, you know, a lot of the guitar players that, you know, succeeded him were much, you got guys who are like Zakk Wylde. They're like huge guys and they're just stronger players. They can pull off these crazy riffs because they have the strength in their hands. And to see like Randy Rhoads, you know, play those kind of riffs and play those like solos and stuff, it's amazing for a guy his size. He's able to do that, and it was just really cool. And you hear like you get like the Ozzy Osbourne tribute. That was like his, that live album is just amazing. And it's like you hear like the Suicide Solution solo is just awesome, because they do get Randy Rhoads a solo in the middle of the song where it goes and then the riff stops and then it goes right into a freaking guitar solo. It's like,
oh, that's cool.
Crazy alternate picking and stuff, and oh, it's just great. And it's just like the magic formula, you know. And I mean, Dio is the same way. I mean, his stuff was like amazing. And like one of it, like Vivian Campbell's like awesome, you know, and like he was great. Because when Dio first came out, that was the first two albums, Vivian Campbell was on that, and he had some great riffs and awesome solos. His tone, everything was just amazing. and it was like fast forward to, you know, a few years ago, he had Doug Aldrich in the band, and there's a live album that he came out with, and like Doug Aldrich had a guitar solo in there, and it's a pretty long one. It's like 4 or 5 minutes, but it's cool because it's like jamming out, really. It's not just the guy just noodling, and they got this riff on there that kicks in, and it was a take on Shame on the Night, the Dio song Shame on the Night, which is like a great riff. And it was like he hits like the bass guitar kicks in and the drums, the riff kicks in, it's just like, oh man, this is just amazing. And you hear the guitar just screaming over it, and it's just like, this is so great. And I would hope that this kind of music would start getting more traction again, because the whole auto-tune thing and this electronic music and stuff, I'm sounding like an old man shaking his his crutch, but or his cane, but I mean, come on, let's get real here. There's so much good music out there. I think if people were to discover it and not just, you know, listen to what everyone else is listening to, you find like, hey, there's a lot of different genres of music I could really, you know, be a younger person to discover this stuff. I was like that. A lot of this music, these guys were having their careers were in their prime when I was like 3 years old. And the same can be said for a lot of my friends and our friends, like me and you. I mean, we're in the same thing. We're like, we discovered these and we went back and we found all this stuff. And that's why we're talking about it today, you know, and it's, I just think that there's a lot of good music out there, and it's sad that it's being ignored, and it's because the record companies won't really push it anymore. I mean, there's so many bands that tour, and nobody knows about it.
Mm-hmm. And you know, the thing for me too is that the bands that do pay attention to like the stuff we're talking about, they're considered like underground, like they're not as mainstream as like the nonsense that's being force fed to everybody right now. Mm-hmm. Because, for me, I mentioned earlier where I've been gravitating a lot towards, like, super aggressive stuff. Like, it's... What's interesting is they'll take elements, like, the base of, like, their music will be, say, prog metal, but then they'll throw in, like, elements of, like, some death metal as far as, like, singing and stuff. But the core, like, all the guys, at least the stuff I listen to, they're all musicians. They know how to play their stuff. They're not just making sound. Like there's a reason as to why they're bringing in the certain elements that they're doing, even though they're, compared to what we grew up with, is very unorthodox. But at the same time, once you get past that initial like shock, if you're not used to that and you actually listen to what they're doing and how they're playing, it's like the exact same stuff that we listen to, but it's got several new coats of paint on top of it, and just happens to have stuff that we're not used to hearing as far as like the singing, or maybe like the drums are just so intense and fast paced and stuff, but these guys can also scale it back and have like a reprise type of song where they'll play something soft and easy listening to give your ears a break before they go back into going full throttle and stuff. And but the core is there, where like, and if you like, I mean, I can name drop, you know, like Scar Symmetry, and I have to go through my list. But yeah, a lot of like the modern bands that I've been gravitating towards a lot, if you read some of their interviews, a lot of their influences are Dream Theater, Megadeth, Iron Maiden, some like more like stuff from the 90s, like some Symphony X, and
that's just a wide swath. That's actually that's great. It's eclectic.
Yeah. And to me, it kind of gives me hope. I mean, it kind of sucks that they're not receiving the attention that I know they deserve. But at the same time, if they did, would they still be the same band that they are right now?
Good point.
At least there's that, to me, there's that promise that even though they're not gaining like the millions like these stupid supposed music artists are getting, at least the people that are growing from the good music that we've grown up with, they're doing really good stuff, and the people that need to listen to it are listening to it. And it's like with to me, Dream Theater is like a perfect example of like, they, as far as I know, they're still considered underground, even though like as the years go on and they tour to different places in the world that they've never been to at all.
They're probably their biggest they've ever been. I mean, at this
point.
They were on Rolling Stone magazine. I mean, when they were on Rolling Stone magazine, I was like, oh boy, I don't know if I'm into these guys anymore. Because it was kind of like what you described. You're like, okay, what's wrong here that they would be given attention to be on the Rolling Stone magazine cover? It's like not even someone like Steve Vai or someone could be on that, you know. Mm-hmm.
That's not to say that if you do make it big enough to be on Rolling Stone, that doesn't mean like your music all of a sudden just turns to crap afterwards.
No,
you know,
but, right? That reinforces your point that the Dream Theater is one of those rare bands that, sure, they sound a lot different now. They sound more big and epic and everything. But it's because they have reached a point in their careers where they know how to get the sounds they want, and you've got the pinnacle, you know, musicians in that band. I mean, they get better and better, and they always improve, and they're always practicing, and they work on their parts, and they stay in sync with each other. And I think one of the biggest things is they all get along so well. The chemistry is there. It's like Mike Mangini. You know, when he replaced Mike Portnoy, it's not they didn't lose anything, but they got a different flavor, and it was like Mike Mangini's just amazing. I mean, it's just so it was like, and I felt that when he joined the band, they started getting a little bit back more to some of their prog sound, a little, not a whole lot, but they picked up that style and carried it with them forward with what they're doing, you know, as far as the big epic sound and everything. You know what I mean? That's just to my ears. Like, yeah.
And I think, what you're talking about is you know, huge examples of like why they're still going and being as popular as they are now. And I was thinking about this recently too, as to, like musical artists or musical acts. When you think about the catalog of music, if they've had a supposed long enough career, you think about like, how their music, the catalog of music is, you know, how it's thought by people, whether it's like, are they one-hit wonders, or do you only know of like certain singles and that's it? Whereas like somebody like Dream Theater or like Maiden or like these bands that have been around for a while, yeah, people have their favorite songs, but they talk about the catalog as in, yeah, this album's fantastic, and within that album, there's all these songs. This album's great. Like, people can break down their entire career and say there's aspects of greatness and for a big part of their career. Even Dream Theater, they've had their hiccups though, but overall they've had a super solid like run and super solid like discography and stuff. And I was also thinking too, like, the bands that survive and can withstand the test of time are more of a global band versus like a lot of like music acts that are popular here in the States. You go out to like Europe and nobody knows half the stuff you would talk about if you're talking just about American pop, because it's just insular in the United States. But then I know if you were to go to almost any part of the world, well, a lot of the parts of the world, and say, Dream Theater, Megadeth, Iron Maiden, you'll have people that just their face will light up and yeah, I like them too, and then they'll start talking about like all the great songs and stuff. And I think maybe it's just me, but I think to me those aspects that I was talking about, along with what we were talking about too, I think that allows bands to survive the test of time, that even when they retire, when they've lost all their physical ability to perform at a top level or any level at all, they still have the music that just lasts forever and stuff. And a lot of this garbage that's being auto-tuned and forced fed down people's throats, but you know, by repetition and stuff.
Yeah.
Wait about a month and stop playing this stuff, and nobody will even remember what that music was.
Well, outside of the U.S., it's a much different scene, and from what I've noticed is that over in the U.K., they are kind of like we were, like, you know, 15, 20 years ago, where there's still a lot of guitar players, and guitars actually, they have guitar shops that actually sell, you know, and they do very well. And there's people trying to get better on their instruments constantly. And there's one YouTube channel I watch. It's called the company is called Anderton's. And
oh, this stuff is great.
Oh man, those guys are awesome. And they had like that big 2.5 hour John Petrucci interview, and you have the guy called the Captain. That guy's great. And then and who's the guy with the glasses that does the videos with him? Rob Chappers. Rob Chappers, he's awesome. He goes, "Greetings, everyone!" Like that. He salutes the camera. It's great. And some of the product comparisons they do, they'll take like a $200 Epiphone guitar and compare it with a $3,000 Les Paul, and you know, they're doing their reviews like, "Oh, this is just great. It has the tuners and everything. It's just so wonderful," like that. It's just really cool. But it's like, in the States, you don't have that. I mean, there's some cool YouTube channels out there still that are really good, but like, you got companies like Guitar Center and stuff, man, they're just not doing well. And then Gibson, they're probably going to go bankrupt.
Wow.
Because they can't pay off their loans. They have these bonds or whatever, these payment bonds that are coming due. They have to pay these, and they don't have the money to pay it. And I mean, I'll tell you what, if Gibson goes under, that's really going to be a huge blow to the. I mean, there's a major guitar builder that's going to be gone, and it's just another. It's because of the auto-tune type music, the electronic music. I mean, it has in the States, is so popular. The traditional music that would use real guitars and everything, real instruments, is dropping off. I mean, it sucks. I think it'll bounce back eventually, because like kind of like you and I talked about earlier, like there's always like a backlash where it's like, okay, well, people are like, wait a second, they go and really rediscover something again, you know, because what, for a while there, you know, I remember back in the mid-2000s, at least over here, a lot of like the teenage kids and stuff, they were discovering Led Zeppelin, and they're discovering Black Sabbath, and you know, a lot of the 70s rock again, and they wanted to play AC/DC and all that, and it was like, so there was a harken back to that. They're like, oh, this is cool, these guys were doing you know, this music where they're jamming, oh, I want to learn how to play guitar. And you know, it was like, I remember I went to the music experience, the Jimi Hendrix experience in Seattle, and the EM Experience Music Project, that's what it's officially called.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, it has like Jimi Hendrix's like stage attire on display, and I mean, that guy was tiny. I mean, he was like built like Prince. I mean, he was a small guy. And it was like they had all his original pedals and gear behind glass, and they had like the Echoplex pedal that he used, and it was just like, you know, I just like, man, if I could just take one of these guitars that's in the glass. Because I'm a lefty, so it's already strung for me, because Hendrix was a lefty. Take this guitar, hook it up to this pedal, and just plug it through one of these 1959 Marshall full stacks, and just let it rip. I would be in cloud nine, you know. And having like one of Eddie Van Halen's Frankenstein guitars that close to my face and not being able to touch it was such a tease, you know. And
did, he's just amazing. Did you at least breathe on or blow on the strings?
I wish I could. It was behind glass, and it's like thick. It's like thick glass, man. It's like 2 inches thick type stuff, maybe thicker than that, because, I mean, they keep that stuff under lock and key, you know. And I'd love to be an employee there, because if I was an employee, I would love to just, I'd like to take a duster and be responsible for cleaning the stuff, you know, let alone not being able to play it, you know. But yeah, so if you're ever in the area, man, we'll go up there, man, because it's something you don't want to miss. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
Yeah. We'll get Ben to go with us, too, because Ben lives pretty close to me. One of a devoted listener, good friend of mine, Ben, we go up there. You know, we go up there sometime. It'd be a lot of fun.
That's cool.
But, yeah, yeah. Yeah, guys, we're just going to be just about wrapping this baby up. You know, we're going to do, this kind of just chips it just scrapes the top of the ice, or I'm not even saying it right, but tip of the iceberg, tip of the iceberg for, this kind of talk. It's not something we usually dive into, but, you know, we're, Jody's also a big fan of music, and we love it, but typically we talk about geek stuff on here, nostalgia, but, you know, let us know, guys, if this is something that you usually want to get into. I know I can go in as deep with music as you want, and, I mean, it's, this is a lot of fun to be able to do an episode like this, and, I just wanted to, Ponch, you got anything before I do a few plugs?
No, yeah, just riffing off of what you're saying, like, my well may not be as deep as yours as far as, like, your music knowledge, but, yeah, I can easily talk all night about this stuff, too. I mentioned it before, but what's so great about metal is that, you know, you have, like, so many genres of different types of metals, and even if you know everything, somebody just does something so interesting and so fresh that a new genre is created. And just to me, it's one of the most diverse types of music types, where you can go, like, there's such a huge range that you can go, bands that are proficient enough, they can go from one range to another, and they would not lose a beat, and it just sounds like something that it's natural and fitting for what they play and stuff. And it's, yeah, I can go on about this all day, all night. It's a fun subject to talk about.
It's like the Eddie Trunk type stuff, you know what I mean? And
yeah,
he talks about really obscure bands that no one's ever heard of. Well, aside from maybe me or Jody, or, you know, it's like talking about a band like Angel, or talking about really obscure stuff. Like, yeah, they take 20 years to put out an album. They're perfectionists. You know, you get the whole Eddie Trunk thing. They're really high pitch. And what I want to do is just a few plugs before we jet out of here. We have our good friends over at the McSauce Podcast, Ian, Paul, and Matt. Check those guys out. They are constantly putting out new episodes. They're big supporters of this show. And I want to thank them on this episode for promoting our t-shirts we have over at tpublic.com. That's a really huge honor for us. And we had Paul on last episode, and that was a lot of fun. And I want to do that again in the future. And eventually what I'd like to do is actually get, I hope in some way, shape, or form in the future, I can do a podcast with them in person. On my travels over there. That's not clear yet when I'm going to get back over to New York, but, you know, I'd like to do something where I can travel down to, Pennsylvania and go have a podcast with those guys. It'd be a lot of fun. But, thank you again, guys. We appreciate your support. I'd also like to give a shout out to Ryan McCormick over at the Fireside Chat Podcast. He's got some great stories on there. He's been on the show. I want to get him back on here, too, and that guy is just hilarious to have on here. We talk about wrestling and stuff, and he's a great storyteller, so definitely check out his show. There's a new podcast. I laugh when I think about this, but Jeremiah McGuire, who's a listener, he started a new podcast called Buns and Roses, and he's a really funny guy, and I think that show's primarily about The Bachelor. And, he's kind of a wine connoisseur, I think. So, if that's your bag, go over there and check those guys out. He's a funny dude. And, I think it's him and his wife and a friend of theirs do that show. That's a brand new one. I think they're about 3 episodes in, maybe. And, so if that's your bag, check those guys out. I want to give them a shout out, because he's a good guy. And, eventually I'll get him on the show as well. We just got to get our schedules to line up. So, yeah, guys, that's going to just about do it. I appreciate you guys hanging in there, and most likely Jody will be back next week, and Ponch, I'd love to have you on as well. So having the three of us on here flapping our gums is a lot of fun. So thanks for being on here today, man.
Yeah, no problem. Like I said before, man, whenever you want me on, just let me know.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, guys, well, we will catch you next time.